philosophy in Southern Oregon, as you all know. She went to undergraduate at Caltech, where she was renowned as one of the most studious, hardworking, and responsible members of the Caltech community. After Caltech, he went to Stanford, where he happily cheered on the fine-scented mascot over the Cal Bears. As you all know, of course, Dave has a literature degree, and over the years, Dave has written some of the most romantic sonnets that the world has ever known. But he's also apparently dabbled in physics and computer science, and apparently that's what he's going to be talking to us today.
Thank you. Yeah, Stanford. Stanford's my mortal enemy. I applied there just to reject them. So anyways, it's great to be here, and I'm going to talk about some of that computer science and physics stuff. Hopefully it'll be interesting, quantum algorithms using Clebsch-Gordan transforms. And I'm, of course, from University of Washington, so the group that I have there, we call ourselves QW, because University of Washington is locally called UW, so we're QW. So one small cat out in the other things. So the other day I was at University of Washington and we were having a faculty meeting, and you know, I had to give this thing about, you know, like the landscape of the land in quantum computing, right? Like where is everybody, et cetera, right? So I put up a slide that was the brief history of hiring in quantum computing, and this was a very easy slide to make because it involved Waterloo in the middle there and then a large number of great quantum theorists. And then some dynamics, and some dynamics that took a little bit longer to unfold than others. And a long time in, finally I'm there, that's hiring to date. So so it's great to be here at the Perimeter Institute, and it's exciting to see so many quantum people around, as opposed to University of Washington, where I look in the mirror to find a quantum person. So it's very nice to be here. So what do I want to talk about? So I want to talk about physics and computer science. So this is my favorite slide about the dialogue between physics and computer science. You can tell which one the computer scientist is. Does anybody know how to tell? It's kind of obvious, right? Okay, look which one has a suit on. That's a computer scientist. The well-dressed one. So, okay. What? Yeah, yeah, so this is the, you know, this is the corporate world, right? The corporate side of computer science, I guess. So usually, what is the dialogue, right? Usually the dialogue is the physicist says, can you fix my computer? And offends the computer scientist, and then the computer scientist asks for smaller transistors from the physicist. But hopefully there's more interesting things that we can say between these two things, two disciplines. Yeah.
I think the computer scientists that you know are different than the one I know.
Yeah, I think so too. Okay, so so the question is, you know, what can physics and computer science contribute to each other? In particular, what, you know, I was originally not just a literature major, but also a physics major. You know, what can you contribute as a physicist? So that's sort of the theme of the talk here. And this is one of my favorite emails that I received from Wim Van Dam about Fox, the theory conference, 2006. He said, Leslie Valiant in his great talk on accidental algorithms said the following. We have all these complexity classes, and we don't know if, at all if they're all, if they are different. It would be a nightmare if they all turned out to be the same, such that NC2 equals P to the sharp P, and so on, right? And then there apparently was some comment from the audience about whether that would be so bad. And he said, yes, it would be a nightmare, but the worst possible nightmare would be if NC equals P to the sharp P, and it was a physicist who proved it. So, you know, somewhere out there, for some reason, the computer scientists are slightly scared of physicists. On the other hand, recently, Scott Aronson, who unfortunately is not here for me to make fun of, had this thing about you know, his fat for trying to get a job, and he sort of had the opposite, which said, you know, he says that, you know, this question of does quantum computing really belong in CS departments as opposed to physics departments, and he argues that in this that all you need to do is change from you know, base it on an L2 norm instead of an L1 norm, and then if you're a computer scientist, your life should be easy, and the hard thing's going to be for the physicist. So I'd like to counter this and say that actually, as a physicist, you can still do useful things. Okay, so we have examples of this, right? So what can physicists contribute? They can, you know, come up with crazy ideas like adiabatic quantum computing and set up lots of crazy debating. And they can also do things like this recent result on NAND trees, where, you know, in order to solve this NAND tree problem, they smoke some weed and come up with an algorithm where they're scattering a wave off of this tree in order to calculate, you know, whether the NAND tree evaluates to 0 or 1. So there is some interesting things they can contribute. And I'd like to continue that theme and say, what else can we contribute? Okay, so let's go back and look at Shor's algorithm. Okay, so what was Shor's algorithm basically doing? Well, the way I think about it is the first step is taking the square root of 1, right? So there's this reduction if you want to factor in. So you try to find an x squared, which is equal to 1 mod n, which is not one of the trivial ones, plus or minus 1. And when that's true, then you can factor your equation like the one below. And then either x plus 1 or x minus 1 share a common divisor with n. Okay, so this is sort of the computer science Turing's up there in the corner part of this algorithm. And then, of course, the reduction is to order finding, right? So how do you find one of these x squared equals 1s, one of these square roots of 1? How do you do that, mod n? Well, you pick this random number coprime within, and then you find the period of that, right? And if that period happens to be even, then you found a square root, right? Okay. And so this is just the standard reduction. Period finding goes to factoring. Okay, so at this point, you know, if you were a computer scientist, you may see all this and you'd be very happy. But now you can sort of try to put your physicist hat on and think about this, and now you have a period finding, which sounds very, oops, that's my little picture of one of these examples, right? So I always like to throw up a lot of ugly-looking pictures. That's a great ugly picture. So put on your physicist, pretend you're Einstein in the upper corner, and, you know, you think, well, okay, what are we going to do? Period finding, you know, period finding is interesting in the sense that you know, maybe it has something to do with something we're used to, which is, you know, translation, right? So, in particular, you know, we could do something like compute this function that we're trying to find the period of, and then, of course, we know that that doesn't really help us, right? We just have computed this function in this other register over all possible inputs, but we can throw away the second register, and then what happens is we end up in this nice situation where we end up with a state on this first register, right, which is periodic. Right, or nearly periodic, in the sense that if you do apply the transition, the translation operation, right, which takes x to x plus 1, to this first register, right, then this thing is approximately periodic. Okay, so you look at this and you're like, okay, it's periodic. Now, what's the first thing you learn sort of in quantum mechanics? Well, one of the first things you learn is this basis change between position and momentum, right? And why do you do that? Well, you do that basically because of this. I mean, one of the main reasons is because of when you have things that are symmetric under translation, right, then it makes sense to naturally work in the basis of momentum instead of the basis of position, right? So in particular, you take that state, you look at the first register, you have a density matrix, which is, let's just make it exactly symmetric under this translation, and that just naturally leads us to a basis, right? Because it commutes, we can now simultaneously diagonalize it. What's the basis that we want to use to do this? Well, the basis is the momentum basis, right? Okay. Okay, so you perform a Fourier transform, and you end up being able then to extract the period. But what I think that's interesting about this is just that what we've done is we've gone from this symmetry to a natural change of basis, right? Whenever we have a symmetry, we know we can do something like this. And that leads us to sort of a transform, which is interesting. And in this case, it ends up solving a hard algorithmic problem. Okay, now there's a second part of this whole story, which also doesn't get told as much, but is also important, right, which is this efficient quantum circuit, right? The basis change just half the story, right? There's almost always basis change which do something interesting for us. But being able to efficiently enact that basis change is sort of the second part of the story. And actually also symmetry plays a big role in this. If you actually look at the sort of most, I'd say, the most beautiful ways to perform some of these Fourier transforms over finite groups and things, all these sort of more advanced Fourier transforms people talk about, there's a group structure that they exploit. There's this tower of subgroups. So symmetry gets applied there. Okay, and if you can do that, then you can do, you know, sort of this thing where what we've done is we've used our computer science out of our head, and then we thought about symmetry, right? And then we knew that a symmetry as a physicist leads you to a change of basis. And then the efficient circuit, we sort of needed some computer science, some recursive structure in order to efficiently enact that. And then if you're Peter Shor, you end up with the algorithm. Okay, so Peter Shor is both Alan Turing and Albert Einstein. So, okay, so what is that moral? So the moral, not the moral majority, like what's his face who just died yesterday. The moral is that we can go from symmetries, perhaps, to quantum algorithms. And I like to use this to motivate thinking about different symmetries, which might allow us to come up with new efficient algorithms. Okay, so the first basis change I learned when I learned quantum mechanics was between momentum and position. What's the second basis we learn? So who has another change of basis? You may have read it in the title. That sort of helps. Okay, well, the second one that I learned in quantum mechanics was the Clebsch-Gordan transform. So remember what this was. You had two spin 1/2 particles, okay, and these usually what we're going to deal with is the two-dimensional irreducible representation of SU2, meaning, you know, we have our two-level systems. We have qubits, right? And there's this new basis that when you're doing physics problems turns out to be very useful, right? And this is the singlet and triplet basis, right? So you now, instead of labeling your states by, say, the projection along the z-axis for each qubit, right, up, down, you now do the total angular momentum, which is this big S, and then the projection of that angular momentum along a particular direction. Okay, and the S equals 0, M equals 0 is the singlet, right, which is this anisometric combination. And then this guy down here is the triplet, the ones that are the symmetric combinations of these states. Okay, and you do this in physics, and when you first do it, it's kind of mysterious. Why am I doing this? Well, there's a reason you're doing it, and it's because there's a symmetry. If your problem has a particular symmetry, then this is the natural basis to use. So what is that symmetry? Why do we use this? Well, we use it because there's a couple symmetries that are important. One are collective unitaries. So suppose we have our two qubits here, and we apply the same unitary to both qubit, right? Then what happens is that you can, in this basis, in this new basis of the total angular momentum and the projection along a particular axis, right? You now have the action of this U tensor U on the singlet, it acts like identity, and like on the triplet, it acts like a three-dimensional irreducible representation of U3. Okay, so that's why you do it, is because when you write it in this basis, it does this block diagonalization for you. Okay, when you do the Fourier transform, when you're doing the discrete QFT, right, what's happening is that it's exactly diagonalizing it. Here we have this irreducible representation, so it still acts non-trivially. Acts like you.
Is that one an identity operator?
Is this? It's a one. It's actually an identity. It's a one-dimensional subspace. So, and I should really say like SU2. Not worry about the other factor there. But. Okay. So when you have a collective unitary, this is the basis you want to use for talking about the action of this U tensor U. Right, okay, so, and you might generalize this, and that's what I'm going to talk about in this talk. What about symmetry under collective unitary rotations? And these don't have to be qubits anymore, but qubits. Okay, so that's the symmetry that I'm going to talk about in the first part of this talk. Okay, so just, that's the collective unitary. Okay, so then what's the other, there's also another sort of dual use of this singlet triplet basis, and that is this, how it transforms under the symmetric group. Okay, so the symmetric group is a group of permuting these two qubits. So you take these two qubits and swap them, right? And the singlet, of course, when you swap, it applies minus one. And the triplet, those are symmetric, right? So it transforms as plus one. Okay, so these two, notice they both sort of also split in these two different ways into singlet and triplet. And again, that symmetry, that type of symmetry, right, is exactly what you, right, that type of symmetry, if you have a swap symmetry, then you would naturally try to use the singlet and triplet states. Okay, and of course, the generalization is a symmetric group on n subsystems. Okay? So these are the two groups that are, you know, sort of naturally are important, that are these groups, these two symmetries, the ones I'm going to talk about, and then the basis changes to the singlet triplet. But there's a more general construction, and this is the Schur transform. So the singlet triplet is, you know, it's two qubits, right? But we want to be more general and think about in d-dimensional quantum systems, and then we want to talk about when we have those in d-dimensional quantum systems, we want to talk about these collective unitaries and this symmetric group action by permuting the subsystems. Okay. Okay. So what happens in that case? Well, there's a thing called Schur duality. It says sort of the following. It says that you can take that Hilbert space of those in qubits. Okay. And there's a transformation, which I'll call the Schur transform, which transforms to a new basis, And that new basis has sort of different registers, sort of in thinking about the quantum circuit type picture of this, right? So in other words, if block diagonalizes that transform, and the label of the block are these Young diagrams, and then there's a tensor product of two spaces. And one is the space where irreducible representations of the symmetric group act, and one is where irreducible representations of the unitary group act. Okay? In other words, if I were to apply a collective U on this side, then that's equivalent to a unitary operator acting over here on this side, okay, conditional on which actual Young diagram you're in, so conditional on which block you're in. Same with the symmetric group. If I commute one of these subsystems, that only acts non-trivially on this SN or F space. Okay, so that's nice. These Young diagrams are just a set of integers. Okay, so they are a set of decreasing integers which sum to n, the number of subsystems, the number of qubits, and there are d of them, where d is the size of our quantity, our qubits, right? It's the dimension of that Hilbert space. Okay, so this is the quantum Schur transform. It's the generalization of the singlet triplet sort of idea, but for qubits. And you might say, well, what use is this? Okay, so that's the first question. Well, when you look at a Young diagram, it should actually remind you of something. You have d numbers, okay, and they sum to n. And if you think about that a little bit, and you have a quantum system, well, a quantum system, you know, somehow this is acting on d-dimensional quantum systems, right? So somehow that sort of reminds you of, well, since there are d numbers, I could divide each of these by n, and then these look like probabilities. Right, so if I take these k sub i's and normalize them, there are d of them, so they sort of look like d probabilities. Right, it's sort of like the spectrum of a density operator, the eigenvalues of the density operator. And in fact, that's exactly the story that happens. And this isn't the main part of the talk, but the basic part of this part of the story is if you take a density operator rho tensor n and you take n copies of it, and you feed it through this Schur transform, and then you perform a measurement on this Young diagram. That provides an optimal spectrum estimate, okay? I don't want to go into defining optimal here, but in other words, if I take, you know, n large, in particular sometimes very large as a function of d, right, then I can determine the eigenvalues of this density operator by doing this Schur transform and then measuring this Young diagram, okay? Okay, so that's one use. And turns out there are a plethora of other uses, okay? So here's a big long list. The basic reason there are a lot of uses is that this is sort of the equivalent of the idea of a type, but for quantum, right? You're sending quantum data, and you want to have some notion of sort of the number of times a symbol appears, right? That frequency. Well, that's what sort of this Young diagram is basically telling you about when you're sending a bunch of independent systems, a bunch of identical systems like this. Okay, so there are a bunch of different applications. But the question that comes up when you see this is, okay, well, those are nice, but, you know, in the quantum Fourier transform, we had a transform that we could also do efficiently. There's that other part of the story, right? And the Schur transform, it's not at all clear for some applications, like just measuring this Young diagram. It's actually, there's ways to do this that don't just involve the Schur transform. But the idea is how do, you know, can we efficiently enact this transform and fully enact it such that we really have access to this basis and this basis and this basis? Okay, so we're stuck in this thing like, is there an efficient quantum circuit for the Schur transform? Okay, or any circuit that's not, you know, what's the best we can do in terms of scaling? Okay, so you think, okay, well, who, yeah?
We mean you can calculate these things by hand, right? The Young tableau.
Yeah, so you can, so the question is how does that scale, yeah. Right? Okay, so if you try to calculate, so this is the next part of my thing, so who would have had to do this, right? Okay, so, well, what are you going to do to save time? I guess this is the efficiency question. Like, if we're going to calculate these things with our Young tableaus, we don't want to spend all the time washing the baby. We want to get it down to as short as possible. And so you ask, well, who would have had to do that? Who would have had to efficiently calculate Clutch-Gordan coefficients? You know, who would have had to do this? Well, you know, this brings you back to physics, and indeed, there's some work in the 60s, by mathematical physicists who are asking this question because they needed to calculate them, right? Because these do occur in physics, right? And they needed to come up with some systematic way to do it. And the basic idea is you can use this you can use basically a recursive. So one of the interesting things about the Fourier transform, there's sort of this recursive structure in it. There's a similar recursive structure that can be made for the Schur transform. Okay, and I don't want to go into details about this because your brain will hurt more than even mine did when we wrote this paper. But the basic idea is there's a recursive structure which allows you to do a the Schur transform over d dimensions and then d minus 1, etc. Okay, and you can sort of recurse this thing. And there have been explicit numbers that you can get for the Klutz-Gordon transform, and in particular that leads to sort of explicit gates that you need to be able to implement. And you can go through this sort of whole idea of doing this to actually end up with a circuit who, if you want to implement it to accuracy epsilon, is done in a size which is poly log 1 over epsilon n and d. So the bad thing here for efficiency in some sense is this d, right? And I actually don't think for this full Schur transform you can get better than this. But in terms of n and for fixed d, for instance, which is what you might be dealing with when you're dealing with these information theory tasks, this is efficient.
What's the scaling with n?
It's bad. It's not bad with n. It's bad with, I think, the d, and I don't think we have a good exponent here.
So what would be the exponent with n?
I don't remember what it is. I thought it was linear in n. Because that's not the complicated part. The complicated part is with b and 1 over epsilon.
So you're not hiding a big exponent in there?
No. But the recursive structure really, I mean, this d, you know, if it was log dn, you'd really have to. But I suspect that that's not possible. Okay, so that's the Schur transform. Okay, so it's interesting. What does it do? It makes all these things tractable. You're washing the baby and doing the dishes, right? So that's nice, okay? So this is where things stood for a while when, so this was work that I did with Ai Tuong and Aaron Perro, and this is where things stood for a while, but the real question was this question of, can we actually use it for algorithms, which is sort of the original motivation of, we have a symmetry, let's exploit it, right? And every time I'd see John Preskill, for instance, he'd ask me, if I'd tell him anything about the Schur transform, he'd say, you know, like, well, is it useful for anything? And he just kept saying this over and over again. So eventually, I got mad at him and decided I would try to find some use for it. Okay, so here's the use, and here's everybody's favorite, well, not everybody's, everybody's favorite and least favorite problem, probably. Okay, so here's the hidden subgroup problem. So this is the generalization of Schur's algorithm. Some might call it the natural generalization, but it's just a generalization, right? Okay, so here's the setup. You have a group, finite group, okay, so it doesn't have to be abelian, it can be non-abelian. And then you have some function from that group onto some set, we'll just call them colors. My favorite is the puke green. And this function hides a subgroup, hence the name, right? Okay, so it hides this subgroup H. So you're promised that the function maps from the group to the set and is constant on left cosets of this group. So you have a group, and remember, left cosets, you have a subgroup, right? Then the left cosets uniquely partition that group up into these nice slices, and the function goes over here, and it's constant and distinct on these left cosets. Okay, and the question is by querying that function, by asking, you know, individual values f of an element of g, you know, how many queries do you need to actually identify this h? And usually we're working in cases where we know everything about the group. In other words, we know the structure of the group. So I'm always dealing with this idea that, you know, it's a known group, that I know all the subgroups in the sense that I know, you know, I don't have to find out what any group structure. I know that. I know I'm dealing with that particular group, that type of setup. So you want to identify H by returning a generating set, whatever, any way you can identify it, that's fine. And you wanted this to run in a time which is polynomial in log the size of the group, okay? Well, why do we care about this? Oh, well, first of all, okay, so Hideo Mamuchi said the quantum measurement problem refers to a set of people, and increasingly the hidden subgroup problem refers to a subgroup of people. But we'd be happy to add more of you, just like the measurement problem people would be happy to add more people to their painful endeavor. Okay, so this is a hidden subgroup disease. So why do we care about, why do a lot of us care about this? Why have we caught this disease? Well, the first observation is that if you do the hidden subgroup over these two abelian groups, Zn and Zn cross Zn, then these lead naturally, in some sense naturally, to Schur's algorithm, okay, and to his efficient algorithm for the discrete logarithm problem. So what was observed very soon after this type of idea was observed was that if you generalize to non-abelian groups, then you have two sort of nice results. So the first thing that was observed was that if you can solve the hidden subgroup problem for the symmetric group, then that would lead, if you could do that efficiently, then you would get an efficient algorithm for the graph isomorphism problem, which is a problem we don't know how to do in polynomial time on a classical computer. And then it was shown by Odette Rigget that if you have sort of the standard quantum algorithm for hidden subgroup problem over the dihedral group, so that's the group of symmetries of a regular insided polygon, right? So you have rotations plus this rotation plus this reflection, right? And so it's sort of a very, very simple, non-abelian group. Then that would actually lead to efficient algorithms for poly-n unique shortest vector lattice problems. Okay, and these have actually cryptographic applications, and there are some versions of this which are NP-hard, but other ones are not. And also, we don't know, there's sort of a gap where we don't know efficient classical algorithms. But quantum algorithms, the dihedral hidden subgroup problem, if you could do the HSP over it, you would end up solving this efficiently, and that would be a big result. Okay. So that's why the fuss is. So let me give you an idea about what this result is. So here's the graph isomorphism problem. So you have two graphs, and they have, say, two adjacency matrices, A1 and A2. And you ask if there is a mapping such that, you know, is there a one-to-one mapping from the vertices of the first graph to the second graph such that the edges are respected? In other words, can I permute these vertices, right, on this left graph such that it equals that one? Can anyone tell, are those isomorphic or not? Are they isomorphic? Come on. You only have to try. Yes? No? Yes. I see a vigorous nod. Yes, they are. So, okay. So those are isomorphic. But you can imagine, you know, when you get to hard graphs, we can sort of get some idea why this is hard, at least naively. So what is the relation of this to the hidden subgroup problem? Well, what you do is you define your function as the operation which does some permutation on this graph. Right, so what it does is it takes some permutation on S2n, and then it actually just does that permutation to the adjacency matrices. Right, and if the graphs are not isomorphic, right, there might be some things here which, when you twiddle this, right, they end up getting the same adjacency. There might be some automorphisms of the graph, but let's not worry too much about that. Right, so if they're not isomorphic, right, this hidden subgroup won't have an operation which swaps them. But if they're isomorphic, what happens, right, is that there's some operation which swaps them and then permutes this one appropriately, and then you still get the same value of the adjacency matrix, right? So it's symmetric under the hidden subgroup for this type of problem, right, has an element which mixes these graphs. Okay? So that's the mapping. How do we try to solve this? Here's the way we've done this. This is the gigantic hammer that we use all the time. We query the function over the entire group, we compute the function, and then we throw this thing away because there's no real information in most of the problems on this function for the general hidden subgroup problem. We throw this away and we end up with what's called the hidden subgroup state. Oops, and I forgot to define the cosine state. The basic idea is what you do, the basic idea of this state is the following, because this state is a coset state. So it's an incoherent sum over different coset states. And this state here is a superposition over all the elements in that coset. So back in that picture where, right, this picture here, right, it's a superposition, you know, ket H is a superposition over all the elements in H. Ket G1 H is a superposition of all the elements in that coset, et cetera. Okay, so you have sort of some coherent superposition there, and then a mixture over all the different possible cosets. Okay, and that's what I'll call the hidden subgroup state. And this is sort of the standard query model for solving this problem. Okay, so what's the first thing? Well, I was talking about symmetries, right? So what do you want to do with symmetries? Well, you want to find them. So let's talk about symmetries of the hidden subgroup state. Okay, so there's a hidden subgroup state up at the top. Now, there's an operation on this space, my space of, you know, my basis for the space that I'm dealing with are group elements, right? Okay, so there's this thing which is called the left regular representation. And what it does is, as a function of G, it just multiplies those basis vectors. So it's just a permutation, it's a gigantic permutation matrix, right? And it just does left multiplication. And if I, you know, apply that to both sides of rho sub h, right, then you get back rho sub h, because what happens is you have this incoherent mixture of these different cosets. And what left multiplication does of these left cosets is it just permutes them. Okay? And so since it just permutes these, right, and that was an incoherent mixture, your state that you get back out is the same, right? So you just permute, you know, it just changes the labeling of these coset representatives, so to speak. So you have a symmetry, okay? If you have a symmetry, what does it mean? It means you can sort of diagonalize, right? And in particular, you can naturally lead to a transformation. What is that transformation here? It's the Fourier transform over the finite group, which I won't write down because it's not too relevant. But the basic idea is that without loss of generality, without losing any information, in the standard query model, you can get to here, sort of throw this away. So now at this point, we have rho sub h. And then you can perform this quantum Fourier transform. And it, like the Schur transform, has three registers that come out. One is the EREP label. One has to do with the left regular representation EREPs, and one has to do with the right regular representation EREPs. Okay, so there's some representation theoretic interpretation of this. But the important thing is that you can just sort of do this. And the question that people have been working on for a long time is, can you solve the hidden subgroup problem using something like this? And, you know, just using something like this. Because this quantum Fourier transform turned out to be good enough, right, when the finite group was abelian. So, you know, what can we do? There's also the separate question of how do you efficiently enact Fourier transform? Okay, yeah, that's another interesting question. So there was a lot of work that's been going on over the course of many years now about how to do this. And one of the questions was, okay, so say you have, you know, you run this with one query and you get out of hidden subgroup state. You could perform the QFT or not, it doesn't matter, because that's sort of, you know, it, without loss of generality, you could do that. But then the question is, do you get any information out after just one query? And so there were the questions of how many, you know, so there was an early, very early result that said if you have log the size of the group number of rho sub h, then there is a measurement which you can perform which will extract h. But we don't know how to efficiently enact that transformation. And there was sort of no idea about any structure across anything that would go across multi-copies, meaning do something like this where you have rho sub h, tensor m, and you do something non-trivial and then find out about the hidden subgroup state over here. And there's actually a very, very strong result, which is the culmination of a lot of research on the symmetric group, which is important for graph isomorphism, about this question. And this was this result of Moore, Russell, Hallgren, I can never say Martin's last name, so, and then Sink. Okay. And the basic point of this result was that if you're dealing with the hidden subgroup problem for the symmetric group, then you can't do something like take one copy and make a measurement. There'll never be enough information even to construct a hidden subgroup from just one copy and one measurement. And in fact, if you have two copies and then do something across both of those copies, you still don't have enough information. Okay? There are cases where just one copy gives you enough information. It doesn't necessarily lead to an algorithm. But there's not even enough sort of information there. In fact, it turns out this you need log g copies before you can sort of do something. Okay, so you really do have to think about things where, you know, you're doing sort of this very general U on all log G copies of this. And this is a strong result in the sense that it gives you, you know, you're like, okay, that means, you know, not only is sort of the QFT dead, but, you know, you need to think about a very big transform across these. Okay, so what's your natural thing to do? Well, the first part of the talk gave you some idea, right? So we're trying to think about things where we're identifying a hidden subgroup by doing some transform across multiple copies. Well, I wouldn't have been blabbing in the first half about this if I didn't think that maybe the Schur transform was interesting. Okay, so, well, we have, let's just take two copies, say, okay, two copies of this state, and of course there's a symmetry here, which is that you're given the same state, and it's symmetric under swap, right? So the first thing you might think is, what happens if I measure the Young diagram, right? So let's do the Schur transform on this and measure the Young diagram, and try to identify H using that information. So that's sort of sampling this permutation symmetry information and see if that helps you identify H. And for the symmetric group, Child, Taro, and Bakjan, well, I also can't say the last name, were able to show that basically this, you know, gave the first preliminary evidence that that doesn't work. It doesn't give you enough information. Okay. So that's kind of depressing. What about, you know, is there some other case where we can start to do this? Well, so thinking about this, one of the things is that the symmetry that I'm exploiting here is collective unitaries and permutation symmetries. But somehow it would be nice to use a symmetry that's more closely related to a group. Okay. So here's a particular group, the Heisenberg group. Here's Heisenberg, and I think that's Bohr. And I'm not sure what he's doing in the background, but he's maybe calculating, or it's unclear, right? So, but they were probably, you know, up skiing or something, right? Nice and snowy. So, so the Heisenberg group is a non-abelian group. It's a semi-direct product of this VP squared semi-direct ZP. Okay, and here's the crazy multiplication rule for it. You have these three elements between 0 and p minus 1. Multiply them together. Here's the crazy multiplication rule. This guy just kind of gets added nicely, and then there's some crazy thing that goes on here. Okay, so it's a fairly interesting group. What's important about it is that we were able to find previously an efficient quantum algorithm for solving this. Okay. This was work that I did with Andrew Childs and Wim Van Dam. So we were able to solve the hidden subgroup problem for this Heisenberg hidden subgroup problem. And what was interesting about this was that if you look at, so there was this approach that we were pursuing called the optimal measurement approach. Basically, given one copy, you want to maximize the probability that you'll successfully identify the hidden subgroup. Given that you're given one of the hidden subgroups with uniform probability. And then you could say, well, what about two copies? We want to find the optimal measurement. And in that approach, this hidden subgroup problem was for the Heisenberg group. For one copy, the most optimal measure, so if I had one copy and I just want to do one measurement on it and, you know, then identify H, the probability of successfully identifying H for the bestest POVM scaled like 1 over p. In other words, it's scaling really poorly because p is related to the size of the group, right? The size of the group is p cubed. Okay, but for two copies, it turned out that the optimal measurement was of order 1, and this measurement was is very closely related to what's called the pretty good measurement. Okay, so that was interesting. We sort of had found this algorithm. The important thing here is that not only is this true, but we were able to actually come up with a circuit which does this efficiently. Okay, but it was still kind of mysterious why that thing worked. The other interesting thing to state here is that the probability of success for one copy is exponentially small. That doesn't mean that there isn't enough information in one copy to extract the hidden subgroup by repeated applications of a particular measurement. And in fact, it was previously shown that with one copy there was enough information. In fact, that was shown in the same archive posting as when we posted our paper. So unfortunately for Martin and others who were involved in that, they posted this thing saying there's enough information, and then we posted an algorithm showing that, yes, with two copies, and you can just do it fairly straightforwardly. But the question is, why does this work? Okay, you know, it was kind of an ugly construction, and at the end I'll show you a little bit of the sort of idea of that. But it's very ugly, I'll just tell you that. It's not very straightforward to understand why it's worked. Working. So I wanted to try to understand, you know, is there some way to understand why this is working? Okay, so there's a problem, right? If you want the Clutch-Gordon transform to come to the rescue, right, like Lassie, you want to have some symmetry, right? These states, rho H tends to rho A, doesn't really have a Clutch-Gordon symmetry. It has this, you know, swap symmetry, but I want to do a Clutch-Gordon transform for finite groups. Right, so I want to talk about the Clutch-Gordon transform of different finite groups because I want to work with the group that I care about, which is, say, the Heisenberg group here. And it doesn't have that symmetry. Okay, so you can easily check that. So I needed to think hard about how you could do that. And the basic result is thinking along the following lines. Okay, so here's the graph isomorphism problem. And before what I did is I allowed the entire symmetric group. I allowed you to permute any two vertices. Right, any two of them or any three of them, right? Like all of them could mix up, right? But more properly, you don't even need to consider those. You could consider just permutations which permute one of the graphs and then possibly do a swap. So that's this Sn reef S2, okay? So it's a slightly smaller group, okay? So it's a subgroup of the full S2n on all these vertices, right? Okay, and then notice that, like I said, what happens is what you're looking for is whether the hidden subgroup, right, has something that swaps them. Because if it has something that swaps them, right, and moves the vertices correctly, right, so it does this such that they line up, then you know that there is, you know, that these are actually isomorphic graphs. Okay? So, but what's interesting about that is if you think about that, this, I mean, that sort of thing has sort of a structure to it that those types of permutations are very different from ones which just do this and just do this. In fact, it motivates you to think about the idea of conjugate subgroups. Okay, so suppose you have two subgroups, H1 and H2. You can call them conjugate to each other so you have a big group and then we have two groups, right? And they're conjugate to each other. There exists an element of the group, the larger group, such that when you left and right multiply by the inverse, so when you conjugate H by elements of, say, H1, or H2 here, sorry. If you take eight elements H2, conjugate by this G, then it transforms into H1. Okay? And, of course, this, you know, sort of, does there, you know, so is this conjugate to this? This forms a nice equivalence relation among the subgroups of the full group. Okay? So, what this motivates thinking about is a different problem. So, it's the same setup. You're querying the same function. So, you're going to be allowed to sort of, you know, the same setup. But now, instead of asking the question of what is the subgroup, we're going to ask which of the conjugate subgroup classes does H belong to? Okay, so in other words, there are these different conjugate subgroups, and then there might be another set of different conjugate subgroups that are, say, larger maybe, and then another set. And what we want to do is we just want to identify which of those classes this H belongs to. So we're asking less, right? Okay, so of course, if we could solve the hidden subgroup problem and we know the structure of the group, which is what I'm normally working with, right, then we can, you know, we can efficiently solve this, right? But the other way around is not as well known. There are a few results, but not very many. Okay, in particular, there are some trivial cases. The first trivial case is if the group's abelian, right, then they're equal, right? Because in that case, all the subgroups are only conjugate to themselves, because G just commutes right through H, right? It's a abelian group, so they're all only conjugate to themselves, right? So identifying the subgroup is equivalent to identifying the conjugacy, the different class of conjugate subgroups. Okay, if the subgroups are normal, okay, then that's true, because the definition of normal subgroups, right, is that G, H, G inverse is equal to H, right? So they're normal in G. And it turns out that these are exactly the two places where we know quantum computers can efficiently solve the hidden subgroup problem. Okay, so I'd like to claim that this is more than just some coincidence, that this is actually trying to tell us something. These two cases are exactly the cases where we're actually solving it. So maybe we generalized too much. Maybe the hidden subgroup problem wasn't the right problem to talk about. Maybe it was the hidden subgroup conjugate problem. Okay, and in particular, it does allow you to start thinking about new symmetries. Okay, so now I'm gonna talk about the hidden subgroup conjugate problem. Okay, so this is the problem of identifying these different conjugate subgroups. And you know, I can talk about optimal measures for this, or talk about, you know, like I'm trying to distinguish these things. But there's a very natural sort of setup for this, which is to bind states which are, so what's happened here is this row bracket on this subgroup is a superposition over all these different conjugate subgroups, right? So I can sum over the entire group action on, you have your fixed subgroup that you're starting with, and then it has all these different other subgroups which are conjugate to it. Right, and I basically symmetrized over the group by doing this, okay? Because I have rho G H G inverse, okay? And I can actually talk about this for multiple copies. So now the setting is I'm querying the same function always, right? The hidden subgroup doesn't change in between these, but the only information that I want to extract is the information about which of these different conjugate subgroups matters. So the natural state to talk about there is the hidden subgroup conjugate states for m copies. Is exactly this state here, where notice that I'm not, it's not the tensor product of that guy up there n times, right? What's happened is on each of these, I've conjugated by G, right? So and that's because in the setting I'm working in, the black box is always giving me the same H, right? The problem I'm trying to determines how I construct this state, right? So what I'm trying to do is distinguish between these different states for different values of bracket H, right? Different conjugate subgroup classes, okay? And so there's this optimal measurement approach that we've been working on where you can sort of try to find the optimal measurement, but what's important is this is a new symmetry, right? So this fact that you're conjugating by where you have this acronym GHG inverse actually means that you symmetrize over the group, Okay, so for that top thing there, it's like this, you multiply by the right action of the group on both sides. Okay? And in particular, this one up here symmetrizes over an n-fold tensor of that right product. And that tells you something because it's a symmetry, right? So in other words, if I take that rho h tensor m and I act on both sides of it with this particular operator, I get out the same state, and there's a symmetry. And that's the symmetry of a Clutch-Gordon transform over a finite group, over this Heisenberg group. And because there's a symmetry, it means that there's some more block diagonalization that you can do on this thing than just the quantum Fourier transform. Okay, so we have these states, and we have now, because this is the sort of information, we're trying to extract information about which of these conjugates, that led us to a new symmetry. Here's that new symmetry. It's this right multiplication, so instead of multiplying on the left, I multiply on the right by the inverse. Okay, so it's just like the left. And normally this isn't by itself a symmetry of the hidden subgroup state. Okay? But when you work in this conjugate subgroup problem, it does become a symmetry. And for m copies, in particular, what happens is you have this thing m times becomes the symmetry operator, the operator that, you know, when you conjugate about the subgroup, gives the symmetry. And now you have this thing where you have, you have this m times, right? So you have this sort of operation m times. And this is the after a quantum Fourier transform. So this is the Irup index for a Fourier transform. This is one of those registers, and this is the other. And then we have it m times. Okay, so it leads you naturally to consider operations like irreducible representation 1 with G tensor all the way up, irreducible operator m with G. So it's this what some people call like a diagonal action. And this is just what we do when we're adding the addition of angular momentum, right? But you can generalize that. And what are you doing when you're adding angular momentum? In the finite group case, you're adding different Ireps. So we have like mu1 with mu2 all the way up to um, and you can find a Clutch-Gordon transform, which is what this is. In other words, it's possible to block diagonalize this, where you get a, like this is like the total angular momentum, but it's a final Irep index. You get some index where degeneracy happens, and then you get the place where this group acts non-trivial, the Irep with Irep mu. Okay, and this is the symmetry of these HSCP states. So what does that mean? Okay, well, the you know, this whole long story tells you that in order to sort of identify these different conjugate subgroup classes, the different ones, you can, without loss of generality, perform a transform where you query the function, do a QFT over the group. That was the previous symmetry people were using. And then you can do a Clutch-Gordon transform. What happens there, so one of these indices you can show, this I sum n, never has any information about the hidden subgroup. It's a fully mixed, right? So it's just random, totally uncorrelated with the hidden subgroup. So you can throw that one away, okay? And that the fact that you can throw that away is related to that symmetry under the left regular representation. And then we have this other index, okay? And now what you do is you perform the Clutch-Gordon transform. You get back out labels for the Ireps. They sort of stick around. Okay, and then this total Irep label, mu. And then you have two indices here. This is where the right regular representation, that diagonal action, acts non-trivially. Because it acts non-trivially and it's a symmetry, it means there's no information here. All the information is in this degeneracy. So if you think about the addition of angular momentum, say, and you start, let me get it, just to draw a little picture here because it happened. You know, if you start with spin 1 half particle and add another spin 1 half, right, you can produce the spin 1 and spin 0, and then you can do some more addition and you can end up with the 3 halves and 1 half, right, so with 3 particles, so this is n equals 1, 2, and 3, okay, right, so there's a degeneracy here, right, like you're adding these additions of angular momentum, and there are two ways to add up to this particular Irep, which is the two-dimensional Irep of SQ2. Okay, that's what this indice is about, that. And all the information is the joint information between, you can sort of classically measure this, and then you'll have a coherent superposition here. And that's without loss of generality if you're trying to solve this the hidden subgroup conjugacy problem. So when you're trying to solve that problem, this is the most general circuit. So does it work? Well, the first thing to show is the following. Is it true that maybe the Heisenberg, this other problem, the HSCP, is actually equal to the Heisenberg hidden subgroup problem. I can solve the Heisenberg hidden subgroup problem. I can go back that way. The hard thing is going the other way. And this works out, and it works out very straightforward by a technique that actually appears all over the place now. So the basic idea is, so you have these conjugate subgroups, okay, and you can identify, you know, you're trying to, let's say you solve the HSCP, so you know which of these different classes of different conjugate subgroups you're in. So you know that, for instance, you're in this one here. Well, it turns out for the Heisenberg group, all of these fit within another subgroup of the Heisenberg group, which in which this thing is normal within that subgroup. So what you do is if you could solve the HSCP, you could find sort of you're basically identifying this other subgroup of the Heisenberg group under which all of your states are normal. And then you can run the standard normal subgroup algorithm. In other words, what you really end up doing is you solve the HSCP and then you run instead of querying over the entire group, you query over this subgroup that you've identified, okay? And that just works out from some nice understanding of what this actual group is. And I don't know how much this generalizes, which is a great question. How often can you do this for going from an HSCP to an HSCP? Okay, so it means that all I really need to do is solve the HSCP. Okay, so what happens? So what you do is you just sit down and you can write down the hidden subgroup states, do the Fourier transforms, throw away the possible things, get the Klutz-Gödel transform, figure out how to add different IRFs of the Heisenberg group, which is very straightforward. You have basically these K1 and K2 are IRF indices, so they're actually mu1 and mu2 have changed into K1 and K2. K prime is sort of the total IRF indice, and then you have all the information here, and then this contains no information. And when you do that, you end up with these states here. And if you look at these states for a little while, you see that they're very nice in the sense that we know K1 and K2. We could just measure them. We know 2. Okay? And then they sort of look like, if I did a Fourier transform over this, it sort of looks like I could extract that out. After I performed a Fourier transform, I could extract out this I, which is, I forgot to tell you that. That's the thing that actually labels these different classes of conjugate subgroups. So I'm trying to identify I. But of course, there's an S squared here. Right? So it's not quite the same, but you think about that for a little while and you say, well, so this is almost like if I did a Fourier transform, I could figure out I. But I need to somehow get rid of that S squared. So what do you do? Well, suppose you could perform a transformation which takes T squared to a superposition of its two square roots. So this is mod P. Okay, so you want to do a transform which takes the square root of this t squared, it produces this superposition. And, you know, really what you want to do is have this occur with high probability. Okay, and that's actually fairly straightforward to do because it's very easy to actually sort of classically calculate these, and then you can use a sort of Hadamard trick to do this transformation, which people will call quantum sampling. So you do that and then perform a quick QFT. Or you may actually do the inverse. I always get this. So you probably do the inverse. So you do this. So if I had a unitary going this way, I run it backwards, right? And then I do that on that. That becomes S squared and S squared. And then I do a QFT over the appropriate structure there. And I end up getting out this exponent up here. I know K1, K2. I could find I. Okay, so what is it telling us? Well, it's telling us that this Klutz-Gödel transform got us all the way to the end. There's still one mysterious thing, which is this transform, right? Taking the square root, putting in superposition. But that's really all you need extra beyond sort of just symmetry arguments. So it almost gets you the full way to solving the Heisenberg hidden subgroup problem. Okay, just to show you what the normal algorithm looks like, to show you that this is some sort of an improvement, here are the hidden subgroup states. Yeah, they're pretty ugly, they're pretty big. You perform a QFT, this is our old algorithm, you get these weird states, they look like this. You end up with some equations, you end up having to invert these equations. If you can erase things, it's very ugly, you end up getting this, and then you want to implement something that's like that sampling that we had before, and you have to show that you can solve these equations. Sometimes there are some solutions, sometimes there are not. That actually occurs in the other one as well, but it's not as big a deal. And then you solve these equations, and then you end up getting this and do a QFT. So there's that other algorithm, actually, you can see the Klutz-Gödel transform in there when you actually go back. But it was much more complicated when we did it, because we didn't know where we were going. We just knew we had to implement this particular measurement. Right? So at least part of that, that whole transformation, why do we end up with this set of equations, which is what ends up happening? You end up with having to solve these equations. Why do we end up with those? That part of the thing is reduced, basically, to just solving the x squared, you know, finding the two square roots of s squared when they exist instead of this more complicated expression. Okay, so that's all I really was going to talk about. So what do we learn? The Clebsch-Gordan transform is useful for quantum algorithms. The big question now is what else is it, you know, what else, you know, where else can we use it? Does it work for other hidden subgroup problems? But also a big question of, for other hidden subgroup problems, when is the HSCP equal to the HSP? When are these the same? And then, of course, the bigger question, which is the one that is more important, is what else can we use? You know, can we actually use this Heisenberg hidden subgroup problem for something useful? And by useful, I don't mean contribute to the problem that is the hidden subgroup problem, generating more and more results. So that's what I wanted to say. This is a picture of me holding up the sun. And as you all know, the sun's not that dense, right? So it wasn't that hard. And then just as a final quick promo, this is my crazy website that I've been working on, sci-rate.com. It's a weird thing for posting, for doing this weird ranking thing on archive papers. If you're bored sometime and you want to waste some time, which I know you guys do because every once in a while I see things on my blog coming from this area. If you want to waste time, this is a great way to waste time, and I would encourage you to look it out. It's a bit broken right now, and now that I'm back from getting married, I will actually be fixing it soon. So that's all I had to say, and thank you for your time.
Probably said this, but I missed it. But when you use a Clebsch-Gordan for the quantity problem,
yeah,
how big are the subsystems that you're doing it on?
Oh, it's just two complex.
Yeah, but how big?
Oh, how big are each of
them? You said it scaled badly.
Oh, the full, the original, the Schur transform.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you're asking how big were? So
two copies, but each of them is the number of qubits, right?
So in the original Schur transform, they were all qubits.
Yeah.
And the scaling was with that, and it was n of those.
Right.
And the scaling was polynomial in the number of subsystems and d.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you said, but d is kind of exponential number of qubits.
So
qubit, right? So.
Yeah, that's right. So if you were doing it on a bunch of, if you were doing the Clebsch-Gordan on a bunch of, right. Yeah, it's where you define your subsystem, right? Like if I have a bunch of qubits,
right,
and then I'm doing it on n of those, right? So
interested in the
Heisenberg.
So
for the Heisenberg, your space is still so that's what's interesting, right? Okay, so for the Heisenberg, I didn't mention this, but for the Heisenberg, your group is, you know, is p cubed, so it's really large, right? So your basis that you're doing this on is really large. And then you're doing a Clebsch-Gordan transform over two copies of that, but you can do it efficiently. So you...
It's
because it's the Heisenberg group.
Oh, okay.
So because that, even for, right, so for that D would have hit me, that D for the original Schur would hit me just with two copies. Right, if I had n equals 2 and D, it would still be poly in D. But because of the group structure, it's actually efficient. So the question for efficient Clebsch-Gordan transforms is this question of, that's another open question, how, when can you efficiently do this? And there's some group structure you need to exploit to do this.
Okay.
But it does go down from D to log the size of the group.
Okay.
Other questions?
Any more questions? Well, thank the speaker again.